Well, good morning, and welcome to our session on sexuality and the young Mormon soul. My name is Jana Reese, and I am the convener of this session, and it's going to be my privilege to introduce our distinguished panelists today. Donna Freitas, who is our first speaker, has been a friend of mine for several years, and this is a very special day because Donna's first novel is being published today. Yes? Mostly today we're going to be talking about her nonfiction efforts, which are considerable and wonderful, but I also wanted to put in a plug for her novel, which is called The Possibilities of Sainthood, and it traces the exploits of a young woman who is a devout Catholic and is fascinated with the saints and decides that she wants to be one, and that since there is not a patron saint of the first kiss, that will be her area of expertise. And the novel has already gotten starred reviews in Kirkus, which is the meanest of all the review organizations, PW, Publishers Weekly, and School Library Journal. 3-starred reviews. So you are really in for a treat today. And Donna will be signing that book this afternoon at 1:30, and also Sex and the Soul, which is the book that will be used for her comments today. Donna Freitas is assistant professor of religion at Boston University, and her most recent project is Sex and the Soul, aside from the YA novel. That book is based on a national study about the influence of sexuality and romantic relationships on the spiritual identities of America's college students. She's also a devoted fan of the celebrated British children's author Philip Pullman, some of you may be fans as well, and has written a book about the religious and ethical dimensions of his award-winning trilogy. Donna's book is called Killing the Imposter God, Philip Pullman's Spiritual Imagination. Her research, teaching, and lecturing has centered around issues of belonging, identity, and alienation with regard to faith, particularly in regard to young adults and young women in particular. Each of our panelists will be speaking for about 20 minutes, and that should leave us half an hour at the end for Q&A, and I hope we'll be able to have a lively discussion. And I will introduce the next panelist after Donna speaks.
I'm going to do something that I never do in a classroom, which is pass on a handout
before I give my talk.
So there's about 30 of these, so I don't know if some of you can share, but the handouts...
Just so you know, the handout gives you just a couple paragraphs background about the study and some findings from the study I thought you might find interesting, as well as on the back there's a list of some of the really... fascinating quotations I got from students during the interviews that I conducted for the study that I thought you might be interested in. So, anyway, thank you for having me here to this conference. I'm very excited to be here, and I was excited to be part of this panel on this topic that I care about so much. Between Jana and Heidi Harris, who's right there, who I've been privileged to have as one of my students at Boston University. I have been awakened to many of the interesting discussions going on among Mormon youth and sex and dating, and in particular, because of Heidi's influence, we spent some time in a class in the fall discussing Jeffrey Holland's sermon on the topic. So anyway, I'm very excited to hear the discussion. So what I'm going to do in the brief 20 minutes that we have here is just basically tell you why I did this study. So there's a story to that that I thought you might find interesting. And then I'm going to tell the story of one student who I talk about at length in the introduction to the book. And I spent a long time discussing with Jana which stories or what I should focus on for this talk this morning, because a lot of the book, Sex and the Soul, is about hookup culture, which I don't believe is very prominent at a school, for instance, like BYU, or at the evangelical colleges I visited for my study. And so I spent time talking yesterday with Heidi about the similarities and differences between evangelical colleges and perhaps a place like BU. So instead, I am going to give you a crash course in hookup culture, which is pretty much what you find at mainstream American colleges and universities. And I'm going to introduce you to hookup culture via students that I've had in a class, and also via a woman named Amy Stone, who seems to have been particularly captivating to my readers and many students at colleges and universities I've been speaking at since the book has been published, and also in the process of writing it when I was testing out some of these stories on students where I was making visits. So she seems to be particularly captivating, and she also really brings together the major issues for the study. So anyway, without further ado, this is why I did this study. On a cold March day, in a tiny room in the basement of a classroom building, 21 students, college students, began plotting a sexual revolution on campus. The unrest had been growing for a while, but the tipping point sticks in my memory. It was just after spring break. A few of my students had done the low-key girlfriend road trip to somewhere local, or gone home for a quiet week with family. One went to see a longtime boyfriend. But most of them had returned tanned and tired from Florida and the Caribbean. They'd partied hard, they'd hooked up, they'd drunk until the wee hours of the morning and then dragged themselves onto the beach by noon, only to start the cycle over again. Many were seniors, so spring break, in its classic alcohol-soaked, sun-drenched form, was the beginning of one final season of partying that would last until graduation. I don't remember who said it first, that the campus hookup scene made her unhappy, even depressed, though she embraced it as if it were the best ever, just a normal part of the college experience. She thought she was supposed to like it, but to be honest, she actually hated it. Her fellow classmates nodded their heads in silent agreement. Then the entire group set aside their willingness to remain complicit about peer attitudes regarding sex on campus and made confessions of their own. "We're not happy with the hookup culture," they said. "We feel a constant pressure to do things that make us feel unsettled. We want meaningful relationships that integrate spirituality, whatever that turns out to be, into our dating lives, whatever that turns out to mean. We live in a community that says one thing and does another. We need to talk about this and not just within the walls of one classroom. Can we change things?" became the class refrain. My students decided they wanted to challenge the campus hookup culture with, of all things, theology. Somewhere in between our readings and discussions, their dismay about campus hookup culture and its lack of romance took root and grew like a weed until they could no longer ignore it. They wanted to stop hookup culture from dominating their lives. They wanted the right to demand more from their peers when it came to sex and relationships. More joy, more satisfaction, more commitment, and less sex. Maybe even no sex. And before I move on, I want to qualify, I guess, what is hookup culture? And I asked every single student, I've been talking about this endlessly now, but I've asked every single student on my study to define hookup culture for me, and talked about it so much with my students in different classes. And the basics you need to know is hooking up can be anything from kissing to different kinds of genital sex. But the thing that really defines it is the fact that it's casual. So generally, someone that you hook up with, you meet at a party at night. You've probably never talked to them before. You're probably drunk. That's another thing that really defines hookup culture, or seems to be an essential ingredient. And basically the bulk of the experience is whatever intimate activity there is. There's very little communication other than the drunken kind. And the other thing that defines it is that supposedly with a hookup, there is zero expectation that you will ever talk to the person again. So no commitment whatsoever, and literally no expectation for anything more than whatever intimate activity occurs during that moment. So this is what my students were sort of admitting that they felt uneasy about, even though they also felt so much pressure to just to say, oh, hooking up, it's so much fun, it's wonderful, we love it. Make no mistake, my students didn't suddenly become pro-abstinence and anti-sex, nor did they deny that sex could be very pleasurable. Many of them knew this to be true from personal experience, nor did they believe that good sex was entirely absent from campus. Sure, some people were enjoying sex, especially in the moment. The problem was that hookup culture promoted reckless, unthinking attitudes and expectations about sex, divorcing it from their larger value commitments, religious, spiritual, or otherwise. After a few years of living in this environment, they felt exhausted, spent, emptied by the pressure to participate in encounters that left them unfulfilled. During class, we began to bat around ideas for confronting campus hookup culture, holding a student-led panel discussion, engaging in a public debate, writing an op-ed article for the school newspaper. In the end, we decided to produce our own newspaper, one devoted to sex, dating, religion, and spirituality. The purpose was to challenge the sexual ethic on campus with both personal experience and religious wisdom in the hope of making romance and relationships more meaningful. The audience would be anyone and everyone who'd listen, the student body, the faculty, the administration, the college president. We would have to raise money to pay for printing. I had ideas for covering that. My students would have to find someone to give them a crash course in newspaper design. They would need to learn to write like journalists, too. Can we really do this, they wanted to know? Yes, I agreed. And with that yes began the most fulfilling and inspiring month in all of my years of teaching. And I actually brought the newspaper they did. I was shocked when I first saw it. It looks like a real newspaper. And I'll tell you the story very quickly of the titles my students first wanted for the paper were, their first brainstorm was Holy Sex, and I said, absolutely not. And then the other one they wanted was the missionary position. And then I said, no way, we might as well subtitle that one, Don't Fire Professor Freitas, please. So anyway, they ended up deciding to call it Dateline SMC, which stood for St. Michael's College, which is where I was teaching it. And you have the in the handout I gave you, they wrote a mission statement for this paper. So this is the paper. They put a picture of themselves on it. And they just decided that they wanted to, as a class, change campus hookup culture, and that together that they could do this. So anyway, you have that mission statement they wrote. I'm still a very proud teacher of them, but it was quite a project. And as you can imagine, on a Catholic campus, which is where I was teaching, it made quite a splash. They actually convinced 22 professors on campus out of about 100 some odd, so it's a lot, to devote their entire day to discussing the newspaper when it came out. And that included, you know, professors from chemistry and in the business school. So when I decided to offer a dating class in the Department of Religious Studies at a Catholic college, I didn't think about whether it would be popular. At the time, I also had no idea that this class would eventually affect the entire campus, not only the students enrolled. Nor did I have any inkling that it would transform my sense of self as a teacher, shape my concerns about college campus culture, and shift the direction of my future research. If there is one thing I learned from the experience, it is that there's strength in numbers, and I can't emphasize that enough, strength in numbers. Alone and silent, my students felt uneasy about hookup culture and about admitting their longing to find meaning through spirituality. Even though the majority had been raised within a faith tradition, students thought that religion had nothing to say to them about sex and dating, and that expressing dissatisfaction with hookup culture was somehow verboten, even at a Catholic school. But when a handful among them found the courage to speak out, the others found their voices too. And what voices? At first, I was taken aback by the student stories about the party scene and the degrading experiences that many of them endured regularly. I was even more surprised to learn exactly how powerless they felt to change this culture that made them so unhappy, at least before they realized that the person next to them and the person next to that person wished she or he could change things too. And somehow, they landed on spirituality as a way out of these circumstances. The student stories, discussions, and newspapers articles made painfully clear that hookup culture does not help young women and men discover the thrill of sexual desire or romantic passion, of falling madly in love and expressing this love sexually. Within hookup culture, many students perform sexual acts because that's just what people do, because they are bored, because they've done it once before, so why not again and again? because they're too trash to summon any self-control, because it helps them climb the social ladder, and because how else is a person supposed to snag a significant other in a community where nobody ever dates? Living within hookup culture means putting up an I don't care front about behavior, occasionally if not frequently submitting to unwanted experiences, and in many cases slowly chipping away at personal standards, expectations, sense of self, and respect, until they are sublimated so fully that a student almost can't remember what they were in the first place. As I looked through this new window into my campus community, I couldn't help but wonder if students at other schools felt the same way. I wonder if there were other Catholic colleges where religious affiliation didn't seem to influence the sex and party scene on campus, or if there were colleges whose religiosity contributed to a healthier social culture, or if social conditions were better at non-religious schools. Were there students like mine across America, seeking spirituality but without much direction, trapped in a hookup culture that coaxed many of them into behavior that made them feel ashamed? Or was the experience about which my class spoke specific to our community? If other students felt comfortable enough to speak freely, would they express the same wish that mine did, if only we could change things? So that's why I did this study. And 7 of those students who participated in that dating class and who worked on the newspaper were my research assistants for this project, and they helped come up with the questions I asked. So now I'm going to introduce you to Amy Stone, again, who's a student that has really, I've heard again and again since people have read her story, I know Amy Stone, or I know a lot of Amy Stones, or I am Amy Stone. So she's someone you might meet at University of Utah, that's right, University of Utah, or the school that I teach at, Boston University. The girl who almost has everything. Amy Stone is the kind of girl you see on the cover of college brochures, a tall, raven-haired fashion model for real, whom you might expect to meet on the streets of New York City. Amy is dressed as if she just walked off a magazine shoot. She'd be a shoo-in for the most popular sorority at any Southern school, the lucky girl who always has a gorgeous date for the football game, unless she's dating the quarterback. She could be the face of an ad for snowboards or ski wear, maybe because that's her job, showing off clothes, accessories, and a dazzling smile for the cameras. By day, Amy adopts the uniform of the average college girl at her Catholic school. She describes herself as preppy. Going out at night is another story. I like to look hot when I go out, Amy explains. I like to be looked at. Amy senses that looking hot gives her sexual power over men on campus, yet she also insists that dressing sexy has relatively little to do with sex. This attention is not so people will desire me or want to hook up with me, she writes. All the students did journals for the study. It is simply to give me a confidence boost and help me feel good about myself. As Amy understands things, dressing sexy is about her feeling empowered and not about pleasing guys or allowing them to dictate what she wears. Amy studies hard and plays hard. The party usually begins in the residence hall with pre-gaming, drinking before heading out to the real party. As the night goes on, girls drink as much as guys because, Amy tells me, alcohol is the catalyst of finally making something into an intimate relationship. When I ask why, she explains, alcohol just makes it easier. You would never just walk up to someone and just start making out with them if you weren't intoxicated. It makes your inhibitions go. Sometimes Amy goes to theme parties, events where students dress up according to a particular set of stereotypes. Pimps and hoes, CEOs and office hoes, and golf pros and tennis hoes, to name the most popular. Girls wear as little as possible, sometimes nothing more than lingerie. Like many students I interviewed at Amy's Catholic College, Amy says theme parties are a campus tradition. Current seniors went to theme parties when they were first years, and now it is their right and privilege to carry on the practice by holding their own. Amy often stumbles upon these events, though, as she puts it, she doesn't intentionally dress the part. Amy worries about getting a reputation since, quote, the girls who are going to go all out and everything hanging out and showing up at a theme party, those are the girls who are going to be labeled as easy or a slut. It doesn't occur to Amy that the premise of a hose party is that all the girls who attend adopt the role of whore. By their very design, most theme parties are about sex and power, with guys in the dominant positions, the CEOs and the sports pros, and girls acting the part of the sexually submissive, sexually suggestive, sexually available, and sexually willing hoes at their beck and call. And some of the other popular ones are millionaires and maids, professors and schoolgirls, so you can just get the idea. And actually, after the Elliot Spitzer scandal, there was a politicians and prostitutes theme that developed on campus. During our conversation, Amy's concern about being labeled negatively comes up repeatedly. Girls have to work harder academically, she explains, since they're expected to have good grades. Girls have to look perfect. Girls have to be the responsible ones. Girls have to be willing to hook up because that's the only way to get a guy. But every time they do, they risk social ruin by imperiling their reputations. Girls also have to live with an apparent contradiction. They want committed relationship, but boys do not. Girls have it easy, Amy says. Guys have it easy, Amy says, on three separate occasions. All boys worry about, she adds, are sports and partying. And, as it turns out, Amy doesn't just dress sexy for herself, but is trading sexiness for male attention. She has known only disappointment when it comes to sex and romance. There is one major thing that the girl who seems to have everything is missing, a boyfriend. Amy thought college would be about falling in love with the guy she'd be with forever, but she, in fact, has never had a boyfriend. You hear about my parents' generation who met the loves of their lives in college, who had this great whirlwind relationship and decided to get married and have kids, Amy says wistfully. Then I got here and I said, oh my God, it's totally not like that at all. People don't want to have relationships. Almost everybody is single, Amy explains, especially the first year students and sophomores. Amy really wants to find a boyfriend, someone who will love her. She's tried everything she knows. Hooking up, friends with benefits, playing hard to get, nothing has worked. Most of her efforts have produced only heartache. Amy is still a virgin, she explains, though she has performed oral sex on a number of boys. But what worries Amy and makes her ashamed is not her experience, but her inexperience. Being a virgin, even a popular, beautiful one, is difficult. Quote, it puts a mark on your head, Amy says. Amy's virgin status made her the subject of a bet among members of the most popular male sports team on campus. Who would be the first to persuade Amy to have sex? And I won't give you the details of that particular part of her story. You can read them if you'd like in the intro. But they were, she didn't, the guy who wanted to, who bet that he could take her V card, is what he called it, her virginity card, did not end up convincing her to have sex, so he got very close, and the only reason why she ended things with him was because someone on a sports team felt bad for her because this boy kept coming back and recounting his exploits with her, and he told her that this is what was happening, that she was a bet for the team. Amy is unsure anymore whether she will save herself for marriage. She used to think she would be a virgin on her wedding day, but now she just hopes that her first time won't be something she regrets, that it will happen with someone who at least respects her, even if he doesn't love her. Her experience with the soccer player has made her leery about trusting guys. Sometimes she even lies about the fact that she is still a virgin. I mean, she says, if the soccer player was talking about wanting to take my virginity, you never know who else is thinking that. If that is for some bizarre reason a priority for guys, to take someone's virginity, then knowing that I'm a virgin is not necessarily going to be a good thing. Now I'm going to tell you a little bit about Amy's religious life, quickly, and then how she's somehow trying to link this to her romantic life, or lack of it. As our interview turned to religion, I pressed Amy to talk more about being a Methodist at a Catholic institution. Her religious affiliation doesn't make her feel uncomfortable or out of place, she says, because you can barely tell that the school is Catholic anyway. This was a theme I heard on all the Catholic campuses. I don't feel like I'm at a Catholic college so much as I feel that I am at a place where you can explore your spirituality, she says. Obviously, when you're walking across campus, you see a priest, and you see a priest, you're reminded you are at a Catholic institution, but I don't think every day, oh, I'm at a Catholic school. This laissez-faire attitude about Catholicism might make her college's administrators blanch, but Amy's views are common. Whatever Catholic culture there is at the Catholic schools I visited is subtle, bordering on non-existent, at least according to the students. Though Amy says she's a Methodist, she adds that she is more spiritual than religious. She thinks of religion in terms of doctrine and constraints. To me, spirituality is who you are as a person and what guides who you want to be. Religion is more about following a certain set of beliefs. I think that is why I veer away from it, because I don't agree with everything that a certain church might say is right or wrong. What exactly does Amy believe? To start, she believes that faith, your belief in God, your sense of spirituality, are personal things that you don't share with friends. just because you go to Mass only sporadically and don't stick to one organized religion doesn't mean that you can't cultivate a vibrant spiritual life. Spirituality begins with a turn inward, and it speaks to whatever you are confronting in a particular moment. I look within myself for my spirituality and to answer the meaning of life, Amy writes in her journal. She also relies on such resources as popular Christian books and the Bible, unlike most of the students at her Catholic college. In fact, Amy is the only student I interviewed at a Catholic college who mentions having a Bible on her bookshelf. Faith in God is a major part of Amy's spiritual identity, though like many believers, she struggles with doubts. Sometimes I long for God to touch me and point me to a religion and say, "This is the way," she writes. Sometimes I feel that maybe I am missing the boat by not being Catholic or Jewish. But then I remind myself that this life is a life given to me by God to do good. As long as I am doing good and growing into the best person I can be, I am good in his eyes. I am not sure what is in store for me when this life ends, but I have faith that it will be good. God is the man with a plan, Amy tells me at several points during our interview. Believing that God has a plan not only for the world, but also for her life, comforts Amy. Her relationship with this man with a plan is intense, intimate, and constant, everything that her relationship with boys are not. Amy turns to God for just about everything, good and bad, large and small. God doesn't have much to say about Amy's sexual and romantic life, however. When Amy talks so explicitly to me about her sexual past and present, her spiritual leanings aren't even a whisper. God disappears from our conversation. For Amy and for many of her peers, keeping prayer private and spirituality personal amounts to the separation of religion from their social lives. When it comes to her stories about sex, Amy's intense spiritual identity and devotion to God simply go missing. Amy confesses that she doesn't have any idea what the official Methodist stance is on sex outside of marriage. "We didn't talk about it in Sunday school," Amy says. When I ask what, if anything, she learned about dating and sex in her church community while she was growing up, "It wasn't preached in sermons. We didn't talk about practical issues at all." To Amy, the girl with a strong relationship with God, who prays all the time and sees God everywhere, sex is a personal choice that each individual must face without reference to religion, a decision she imagines she must face without the help of the man with the plan. This choice is not entirely divorced from God, however, since Amy believes that sex and dating can affect a person's relationship with God. "I really think that all experiences will affect your spirituality in some way," she explains. "Whenever myself is affected, my relationship with God is affected too, because I am leaning on him for different things and asking new things of him." Amy also thinks that sex can be a sacred or spiritual experience in certain circumstances, and she has experienced sexual intimacy, though not intercourse, as a spiritual connection, as she called it, with certain boys. "When you are hooking up with someone and you are staring into their eyes," she says, "you can almost see the connection drawing from eye to eye. I think that that can be very spiritual." Though Amy can speak of two moments in her sexual history that she not only considers positive, but significant enough to call spiritual, because they include an emotional aspect. Neither of these occurred in the context of a committed relationship. Fearing that the kind of romance she once expected isn't in the cards, she's trying to put the best possible spin on her hookups. Although Amy may privately identify a sexual encounter as spiritual in retrospect, neither she nor her hookup partner openly labeled their experience together as spiritually significant. This part of the story, the spiritual part, Amy kept from her friends too. Navigating sexuality in relation to spirituality, as Amy Strone is struggling mightily to do, is, for most American college students, a private affair. But unlike most of the students I interviewed, Amy has found in her personal spirituality at least the beginnings of a resolution to her search. It may not be perfect, but at least she can see a way forward, however dimly lit and lonely it appears to be. I'll be curious to know how some of the young people you know compare to this portrait of Amy Stone and the one I shared with you about my students during the question and answer session. Thank you so much.
Not everything went wonderfully at St. Mike's after that newspaper was published, I guess I can say. And Donna is now teaching at Boston University. And one of her most brilliant students at BU that Donna has been talking to me about for some time is Heidi Harris, who is our second panelist today. And Heidi attended BYU, graduated from BYU in Humanities and History, and has an MA from Boston University in American Studies. She's taken two courses with Donna, one on religion, youth culture, and sexuality, that was a seminar, and one on women and spirituality. And so Heidi's research has dovetailed somewhat with Donna's own interests in religion and youth culture. And through Heidi, Donna has become more interested in Mormonism as an area of study. And also, Heidi would like us all to know she's getting married, speaking of sexuality, dating, and all the things, romantic things. She's getting married next month, so Heidi Harris. Oh, and I also forgot to say that this session is co-sponsored by Dialogue, and I'm a member of the Dialogue Board of Directors. Apparently, I was supposed to get a plug in that about that in the beginning, and I forgot, so yay, Dialogue. Yeah.
Hello. I first want to say I've been very grateful to meet Dana these past 2 days and to be speaking with Donna, who is my all-time academic role model and a very important personal role model for me as well. This paper I'll be giving is coming from a talk I gave at the Center for World Religion and Culture at BU. It was an hour-long talk with an hour of questions. So it's significantly shortened. but it was very popular, actually, and I'm not surprised, seeing as my title included the words popular culture, Mormonism, and sex. It seems like quite the interesting topic. So I hope this is informative, and I hope I'm not too far off the mark, and I hope that it dovetails with Bob. all right, so along with popular Facebook groups like I'm Friends with the Ducks at the Botany Pond, Awkward Engagement Pictures Rock My Socks, and John Got His Mission Papers, Where Is He Going to Go?, one particular group caught my eye when recently pursuing Brigham Young University's online network in preparation for this paper. I was looking for something specific I had seen before and been invited to before, and suddenly there it was, 43,000 students strong, a recent phenomenon among the Jell-O Belt's Facebook savvy, with friends, referring friends to link up with others and saying, I'm saving myself for wild, passionate, awkward honeymoon sex. Today, Mormonism is seen and considers itself as sexually conservative in practice. But also, in my opinion, Mormonism is sexually liberal in theology. This dichotomy creates a type of double consciousness within the minds and cultures of single adults particularly, a group that, as they get older, notice the strain between practicing an almost evangelical standard of conduct while hoping and believing in a very sexy religion, if I can call it that. Of course, Mormonism accepts much of the same theology of sexuality taught in more mainstream and evangelical Protestant religions, particularly from passages in the Bible. Spencer W. Kimball used Billy Graham quotations within an article on sexual morality in 1974, after all. However, Mormonism also includes certain unique doctrines that add to these biblical passages and flesh out a theology that is very pro-sex, describing a physical, anthropomorphic, and sexual God consisting of a male and female deity, the idea that our purpose in life is to become like that God, and the idea that the fall in Eden was necessary and good since it gave us physical bodies and sexual power. In this paper, I'd like to explore some aspects of young single adult popular culture at BYU. Then, presenting some statistics, I hope to suggest that having this double consciousness of conservative practice and liberal theology has been a contributing factor to significantly low numbers of premarital sex within young LDS populations. Essentially, that having this dichotomy in our religion provides a wide spectrum between conservatism and liberalism, which allows students to make choices that find a certain balance and a relatively painless integration of rules and the reasons behind them. In the last 6 years, Mormons have become particularly adept at making fun of themselves in popular media. In 2002, the feature-length spoof The Singles Ward mercilessly roasted, with a good deal of fun, the strange social worlds of young single adult LDS congregations in northern Utah. And then followed The RM, a film particularly concerned with dating, courtship, and marriage. The Singles Ward 2, Bride and Prejudice, Beauty and the Beast, came afterward in short order. And these are just the films, not including the explosion of popular books like How to Stay Chaste, T-E, While Being Chaste, S-E-D, and even a few YouTube crazes like Sexy Stash, spoofing JT's sexy back. JT is Justin Timberlake, by the way. With a group of mustachioed BYU men virally strutting around campus, showing off the only kind of facial hair allowed in the dress code for male students. No wonder the Library of Congress added a new title category into its catalog in February for Mormon wit and humor. What all these films and books reveal, though, is an intense preoccupation and self-consciousness about sexuality, or the lack thereof, and being Mormon. While openly mocking and deriding an overtly sexual music video like Sexy Back, Sexy Stash also gets laughs through the sheer absurdity of three LDS young men rapping out lyrics like, "Them freshman girls just don't know how to act." The message may seem confusing, but ultimately I think it can be boiled down to, first, a desire to break from what is considered negatively and overly sexualized popular American culture by making fun of it, and second, insist that through choosing to practice abstinence before marriage, they are not repressed asexual people, because they show themselves as, like I quoted before, virile and strutting. Perhaps the best example of this complicated mixture of satire, preoccupation, and self-actualization of sexuality comes from the soundtrack to the comedy Sons of Provo, a film which, in mockumentary style, follows the rise and fall of a boy band from the environs of BYU. Among their hits are two particularly pertinent songs, the white boy rap, Diddly Whack Mormon Daddy, and the crooning ballad, Love Me But Don't Show Me. Here again, we have the insistence on abstinence mixed with a denial of their asexuality. Just to point out a couple spots to illustrate. Quote, "You make me feel so handsome, like a shining dark stallion," paired with a line like, quote, "But don't you even try to use the gift of tongues," alluding to French kissing. Just like the Facebook group I mentioned in my introduction, the Sons of Provo make it clear that they are chastely waiting for honeymoon sex, but you can bet when it happens, it's going to be wild and passionately awkward. There is always some sort of truth behind any satire, and in this case, the Mormons themselves make it a favorite pastime to spoof their sexual conservatism. It retains its humor only because of its validity. Last year, BYU Studies, an interdisciplinary journal, I'm sure we all know about it, published the results of a 2002 survey on dating and marriage at BYU. It is the most recent of four such studies that I am aware of. Oh, actually, I need to change that. Five, because I just read a book called Multiply and Replenish, which is fantastic. Five studies I am aware of attempting to statistically determine the sexual practices of single Mormon men and women, the second, third, and fourth done in the mid-70s. Though the methodology of both studies could definitely be improved and expanded, I think that they can provide some useful evidence. In the most recent study of BYU students in 2002, 3-4% reported having had premarital sexual intercourse. I recognize that this number is perhaps lower than the reality for a couple of reasons. First, even though the study was blind, students may have underreported out of fear of receiving an honor code violation. Second, students may have underreported out of a sense of shame or embarrassment not uncommon in social and religiously conservative cultures. Regardless of these considerations, however, even adjusting the results for possible underreporting, I think the percentage remains remarkably lower than the 60-70% reported on average at other college campuses, though other studies put that number between 70-85%, and talking to Donna, that can even go up to 90-95%. In addition, BYU students are conservative in other areas of physical affection. When asked what was appropriate for a hanging out relationship, only 30% said holding hands, hugging, and kissing were admissible. Only 1-3% allowed for making out and intense kissing, or NCMO, N-C-M-O, in a hanging out relationship. And this seems to be the Mormon version of hooking up, completely absent of alcohol, I'll add, since it's rated the number one stone-cold sober school in America. Of course, not all young Mormon men and women attend BYU, and the sexual practice of these members should be considered as well. Though BYU is often seen as a good case study to determine broader LDS practices in youth and single adults, It is important to consider the influence such a large community, upwards of 30,000, of same-minded students can have on sexual practice as almost a form of chaste peer pressure, a type of, come on, everybody's not doing it. Subsequently, observing the sexual practices of Mormons outside of BYU may reveal more of how the religion, and maybe the theology on its own, affects practice rather than the combination of a strong peer community and religion at BYU. In 1976, a national survey of LDS college students determined that of active or practicing Mormons, 19% of men and only 1% of women had participated in premarital sex. Again, I repeat that there is most likely a statistically significant underreporting from women due to regrettable conservative attitudes about female purity. Of non-practicing Mormons, these numbers jumped to 63% in men and 52% in women, close to the national average at the time. These numbers are not surprising, as a non-practicing Mormon is not attending church services, involved in doctrinal discussion, or included within the strong community ties that often characterize an LDS congregation. Without a theological foundation and the strength of community, of course these teens and young adults would more resemble a more secular or national average. In the 1971 National Survey of Young Women, no distinguishment was made between practicing and non-practicing female Mormon teens, essentially averaging the two to report that 15% had had premarital sex compared to the national average of 26%. From these numbers, we can determine that active LDS students and young women, and most likely young men as well, report significantly lower numbers of sexual activity compared to non-practicing Mormons. In 1985, Miller and Associates surveyed several high schools in three western states in an attempt to determine what social factors predicted sexual activity in teens. In this study, 17% of Mormon students, both male and female, active and inactive, averaged together, reported having premarital sex, compared to 48% of Catholics, 51% of unaffiliated students, and 67% of Protestants. In their multiple regression analysis, religious affiliation was second only to church attendance in predicting sexual experience. I will add here that I think the broad category of Protestant skewed that category significantly and would have been much more helpful if separated out into more liberal versus evangelical conservative Protestant denominations. Again, I want to recognize that these studies are obviously dated, and we should also allow for underreporting to some degree, especially in the gender-specific categories. Nevertheless, they do provide a valuable generalization, which is to say that, on average, practicing Mormon youth and single young adults are significantly more sexually conservative than the national average, even when not within a strong peer community such as is found at BYU, and that religious affiliation alone had a noticeable control in their premarital sexual activity. Though I did mention in my introduction that I would not be analyzing married Mormons, I do think it's significant to mention that young LDS adults tend to marry younger. In Utah County, where BYU is located, the average age of marriage is 22 for women and 24 for men, compared to the national average of 25 for women and 27 for men. That's a 3-year difference. From my perspective, this is because of Mormonism's unapologetic encouragement and optimism about married and family life, as well as, no doubt, a desire from both genders to become sexually active within the parameters of a committed relationship and in accordance with their LDS theology. A large student population also provides for more potential marriage partners, increasing the chances of marriage as a student. As one anonymous commentator wrote in an open forum about the 2002 study, however, he said, "There is just as much sex going on at BYU than at any other university. It's just that the BYU students get married first." Which isn't too far off the mark. As of April 2007, 63% of men and 55% of women graduating were already married. From what I have described here, the conservative sexuality of LDS members is not that unique from that practiced by evangelical youth and single adults. In Dr. Donna Freitas' new book, Sex and the Soul, which we've talked about, she describes many of the same phenomena recorded at BYU, also at evangelical universities across the nation. Students strive to remain sexually abstinent before marriage, make up specific and sometimes elaborate rules for themselves and dating relationships. There are similar issues with guilt and fear of rejection from community. Many marry young, and they even talk about NICMO. Freitas' study of two evangelical college campuses provide a possible comparison point in statistics, though I realize comparing two separate studies can skew some assumptions. Regardless, it may be interesting to note that in Freitas' study, between 20 and 35% of evangelical students reporting having engaged in premarital sex, still well below percentages reported in Catholic, private secular, and public colleges, but still well above the 3 to 4% reported in the 2002 BYU survey of LDS students. I would be extremely interested in conducting a study between LDS and evangelical college students in the future to explore this apparent discrepancy between two self-identified conservatively practicing Christian religions. There are theological similarities between Mormonism and evangelicalism, after all, including teachings on sexuality. This is not surprising because the Mormons include the Bible as part of the canon. Both evangelicalism and Mormonism therefore draw from a common source. Lessons for Youth, which teach that sexuality is a unique form of love God granted for use only between a married couple, can be found in both evangelical and LDS Sunday school. Warnings against dating too early, passionate kissing, and pornography addiction are found in pamphlets for Mormon youth and in evangelicalism's very popular battle series. Both LDS materials and evangelical materials have answered the question of why should I remain chaste before marriage and loyal afterwards with the simple because God commands it. But at the same time, Mormonism has added more to the discussion beyond what can be found in the Bible. Not only does it have a significantly larger canon of scripture from which to draw, but is also open to new ideas, new canon, and even changes over time. Moreover, some of the most defining theologies of Mormonism relate directly to a theology of sexuality. Unfortunately, because Mormonism in the 20th and 21st century has been increasingly concerned with looking mainstream, institutional literature does not make these direct connections as much as they should and could. And a more generally accepted and uniquely Mormon theology of sexuality still, in my opinion, needs to be made. As regards an LDS theology of sexuality specifically, members are taught broad principles and standards very similar to other conservative Christian sects, S-E-C-T-S. No sex before marriage, S-E-X. Complete fidelity within marriage. Marriage is between a man and wife. Sex is for procreation and a unique expression of love valid only between married couples. As for explaining why these principles exist, there's not much in the institutional literature or theology beyond it's a commandment, and keeping the commandments brings happiness. Of course, many ethical explanations are offered, like you can avoid pregnancy out of wedlock, avoid disease, it will be something you will give only to your spouse, what a meaningful thing. And if you wait, you can enjoy it in the stability of a committed relationship. However, I would not consider any of these reasons to be directly theological in nature. However, there are latent doctrines within Mormonism, uniquely Mormon doctrines, that would provide a fascinating systematic theology of sexuality. And they are doctrines known generally throughout the membership, and from my experience, are openly discussed and weighed in singles wards and church campuses. Even though there isn't much published out there, as a story from Brent Barlow, a popular writer of LDS marriage counseling books, attests. He was once asked if Mormonism had a theology of sex. After thinking for a while, he replied, "We believe in it." There is so much more than that, though, Brent Barlow. He could have at least acknowledged a BYU devotional given by Jeffrey R. Holland entitled Of Souls, Symbols, and Sacraments, which was the first attempt I am aware of to use uniquely Mormon doctrine in explaining sexual ethics. Though not a complete or exhaustive analysis of an LDS liberal sexual theology, it has been printed into pamphlet form, widely distributed, and I appreciate its influence and ideas. And most notably, it was given particularly to the young single adults at BYU. A conservatively practicing, liberally theologizing LDS college. Where women promise ice cream to their roommates at a relationship's first kiss, and men walk their dates to the door, but where all of them believe that they will be physical, sexual beings for eternity. In considering how to end, I at first tried to bring up again the idea of a double consciousness for young single adults, a split mind that could sometimes obsess about whether a back rub was permissible with their fiancé, but at the same time inhabit a theology that defines them as divine, eternal, and therefore sexual beings. But then, on reflection, I wondered if a better way of describing the phenomenon was not to present the young single Mormon mind as conflicted, but rather a mind that could view a wide spectrum of thought at once, the two consciousnesses representing both endpoints of their understanding, and within this spectrum find a type of balance that empowers them to act within conservative boundaries because of their unique radical ideas that validate and celebrate their eternal sexual nature. I know I can't prove it because it's speculation from my perspective, but could we consider the possibility that this setup, this everyday integration of practice and doctrine, is partly responsible for 97% of BYU students remaining abstinent before marriage? The numbers are remarkable, and they deserve a deeper consideration and a deeper discussion with students and young adults, not simply about their sexual practices, but the reasons behind them. Their faith, convictions, and nuanced personal theologies that no doubt are created in a religion that in many ways makes every member a theologian. Thanks.
Thank you, Heidi. I confess that with the decade that separates us, I thought that JT meant James Taylor. Well, apparently not. Our final speaker is Bob Reese, no relation. He is Director of Education and Humanities at the Institute of Heart Math. He has taught humanities for over 40 years at various universities, including UCLA and UC Santa Cruz. He was a Fulbright Professor of American Literature, and you're going to have to help me with the pronunciation of this Lithuanian university. Okay, it was a university in Lithuania whose name I cannot pronounce. He has also lectured at universities in Latvia, Estonia, Kaliningrad, and China, as well as in the United States. Reese is active in Mormon studies and currently serves on the advisory committee of the Council on Mormon Studies at Claremont Graduate University. His work has appeared in such publications as The Ensign, BYU Studies, the Journal of Book of Mormon Studies, and Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. He is the editor of The Reader's Book of Mormon, which just came out earlier this year from Signature Books. Reese has held a number of church callings, including bishop, and I think he will be reflecting on those experiences today, seminary and institute teacher, and counselor in the Baltic States Mission, where he and his wife Ruth served as education and humanitarian service representatives for 3.5 years.
Someplace back there, I think we are related, Janet.
I hope so.
Some people felt conflicted between the session going on next door, which is why I stayed, and this one, which has to do with sex. And I was talking to some back there, and they say, well, why I stay is because of the sex. I would like to begin with a Zen story that I think reflects the conflicting attitudes towards sexuality in Mormon culture. Tenzan and Ikado, two Buddhist monks, were walking down a muddy road together one day. Coming around a bend, they saw a beautiful young woman in a pink silk kimono with a pink camellia in her hair. Trying unsuccessfully to cross the road without hesitating, Tenzan went over, picked her up, and carried her to the other side. Ikado did not speak again until that night when they reached a temple, when he said, "We monks do not go near women, especially young and beautiful women. It is dangerous. Why did you carry that young woman today?" Tenzan replied, "I left the young woman there by the side of the road, Ikado. Are you still carrying her?" I think that any young person looking within Mormon culture would find some things confusing. There are the enlightened ideas about human sexuality that I spoke about and that I will say a few words about. Ideas that in some sense countered centuries of misinformation and repressed ideas about sexuality. On the other hand, that same Joseph Smith practiced at least three forms of marriage, monogamy, polygamy, and polyandry. Polygamy was practiced at least by a certain percentage of Mormons in the 19th century and some into the 20th. In the 19th century, if you read Journal of Discourses and other things, you find celibacy listed among the great evils of civilization. And in fact, it's interesting in Bruce R. McConkie's Mormon doctrine that celibacy is linked with heresy and all kinds of other things. And yet celibacy has a resurgence in Mormon culture in recent years, especially in relation to homosexuality. There are the narrow and strict sexual limitations that are expected of active and faithful Latter-day Saints, including the idea that all sexual expression, including self-pleasuring, are not appropriate outside of marriage, and probably even self-pleasuring not within the confines of marriage. Even limitations of sexual expression within marriage, where some people feel that oral sex and other perhaps experimental kinds of sex are not appropriate. So you have all of that, and yet you also have the other side of the coin, whatever it may be. My friends who are non-Mormon tell me that if you put into Google pornography by state, that Utah comes up number one. That could be because they're reporting it as being inappropriate. It could be because there's more pornography watching here than there might be elsewhere. Someone told me that recently on a visit to Salt Lake that he heard that state presidents and bishops along the Wasatch Front were being asked to call in Melchizedek priesthood holders and to ask them when was the last time they watched pornography. I don't know whether that's true or not. I do know that there are a surprising number of out-of-wedlock births. That is surprising to those of us who are members of the church. And there is also the extraordinary high rates of suicide among young Mormon men between the ages of 17 and 25. There is the cultural context that this is such an important thing, that is, sexual expression is, that if you happen to fall, then you might as well, all is lost, you might as well go ahead and keep going with it. In the more than 5 years I served as bishop of the singles ward, sexual transgression was the most pervasive, persistent, and painful problem I had to deal with. I saw as part of my calling, helping members of my ward to have a healthy emotional and spiritual understanding of sexuality. According to Latter-day Saint theology, our sexual nature, our sexual power, our sexual identities are all gifts from loving heavenly parents who are themselves sexual beings. That our Heavenly Father and Heavenly Mother are sexual beings is one of the most significant and yet radical ideas of the Restoration, and one that sets us apart from the rest of Christianity. A related but equally radical idea, one that other believers find scandalous, is that we may become like God in this way, that is, that we too may become eternally sexual. In general, such doctrines are abhorrent to most other believers because they tend to see sex and sexuality not as spiritual, but carnal. As Mark Twain quipped, "Of all the delights of this world, man cares the most for is sexual intercourse, yet for some reason he's left it out of his heaven." But it is squarely in the Mormon heaven. Joseph Smith's vision in the sacred grove restored the lost truth that we were created, literally, spirit and body, in God's image. He taught that matter is not only not evil, but in a reversal of Platonism, that the spiritual itself is really material. As Joseph Smith said, quote, "All spirit is matter, but it is more fine and pure and can only be discerned by purer eyes." He taught that when our bodies are purified, we shall see the spiritual and the physical as part of a seamless whole. Joseph Smith might have agreed, although I think probably many contemporary Mormon leaders would not, with his contemporary Walt Whitman, who said of his body, "Welcome is every organ and attribute of me. Not an inch nor a particle of an inch is vile." In addition to teaching these enlightened concepts as a bishop, I saw my task as attempting to counter some of the typical misconceptions that impede and obscure one's commitment to sexual integrity. These include the following. One, it is not natural to suppress our sexual feelings or normal to control our sexual desires. Doing so endangers our physical and mental health. Of course, it is not natural to suppress these feelings, but then, as believers, we believe that God requires us in many ways to go against our natural inclinations. As Scott Peck says, all self-discipline might be seen as teaching ourselves to do the unnatural. The second misconception is the need for sexual expression is more powerful than we are. It is greater than our ability to control it, and we have no choice but to surrender to our sexual urges. In actuality, we are free to choose in this domain as in others in which the Lord has given commandments. Another false understanding is that our power over our sexual feelings is ultimate. We can stop any time we want once we become sexually aroused. In reality, as many can attest, when we persist in inappropriate sexual activity, degree by degree we abandon our agency until we have almost none left. As Linda Paston says in her poem about giving birth to a child, I signed for this at a moment when I would have signed for anything. One of the most destructive misunderstandings about sexuality is that women are not as fully sexual as men. This belief has robbed women of their full sexual identities and has resulted in centuries of male sexual dominance. God created men and women as fully sexual beings, while they may be different in their sexual needs and expressions. Both genders have the capacity to find full sexual expression and fulfillment, and appropriately they find it together in mutual pleasure and joy. There is no question, however, that centuries of cultural conditioning have made men more sexually aggressive than women and more inclined to sexual gratification. I believe that the principles governing priesthood conduct is outlined in the 121st section of the Doctrine and Covenants, refers to sexual as well as to other kinds of behavior. Fifth, another misconception is that it's okay to engage in sexual behavior as long as you don't go all the way. From my experience, this is a particularly dangerous attitude. When members of my board came to me and said, "Technically, Bishop, I'm still a virgin," I knew that was time to become concerned. With chastity, as with all the principles of the gospel, we should be concerned with the spirit rather than with the letter of the law. A related myth is that if we engage in these activities, it's not all that serious and we can easily repent. Based on my experience, however, I believe that these experiences can subtly yet pervasively erode our self-respect as well as our spirituality. One of the most powerful tools for persuading us to believe in these false ideas is the media. Sexually seductive, suggestive, and explicit material is all around us, reflecting the evils and designs which exist in the hearts of conspiring men and women, according to the Doctrine and Covenants. Pornographic and even erotic material can become addictive. St. Augustine speaks of coming to Carthage, where he said, "A cauldron of unholy loves sang all about my ears." Those holy loves still sing to us from the four corners of our lives. Every place we look and listen, the siren sounds of sex beckon us. Even seemingly innocent advertisements contain subtle and sometimes subliminal messages of sexual enticement and excitement. The biggest problem with these messages is that they lead us to see our identities first and foremost as primarily sexual rather than as whole, integrated beings. If we are primarily sexual beings, then sexual fulfillment must be our highest goal. One of the main problems with much that we see in the media is that it presents an illusory picture of intimacy. Speaking of this, Victor Brown says, "Illusions deal with fragments of human beings, not with whole human beings. Illusions deny the consequences of human behavior. Illusions deal in indulgence, not discipline. If we relate to each other in fragments, at best we miss full relationships. At worst, we manipulate and exploit others for our sexual gratification. Through fragmentation, the larger matter of human intimacy is reduced to the smaller part of sex. Sexual fragmentation is particularly harmful because it is particularly deceptive. The intense human intimacy that should be enjoyed in and symbolized by sexual union is counterfeited by sensual episodes which suggest but cannot deliver acceptance, understanding, and love. Such encounters mistake the end for the means, as lonely, desperate people seek a common denominator which will permit the easiest, quickest gratification. My conclusion in dealing with members of the church who have engaged in illicit sex is that while such encounters may provide momentary pleasure, they do not provide lasting peace or happiness. I am haunted by the words of a former member of my ward who, in explaining her improper sexual behavior, says, "I would rather be loved than saved." She had several abortions, had been disfellowshipped from the church, spent a number of years wandering in the dark and desolate spiritual wasteland. She thought she had chosen love over salvation, but in reality, she experienced neither. Much has been written and said about the sexual revolution, a revolution that has taken place during our lifetime. I had a conversation with President Hubie Brown not long before he died. In speaking of the civil rights movement, he said, "Remember that at the heart of every revolution is an important truth. The important truth at the heart of the sexual revolution, in my opinion, is the same message that Joseph Smith revealed more than 100 years before that revolution began. That sex is ordained of God, and like all of God's creations, it is good. To the extent that the sexual revolution freed men and women from some of the more negative ideas about sex, its effects have been positive. To the extent that that freedom has led to impersonal and uncommitted sex, promiscuity, sexual license, and deviant sexual expression, its effect has been negative. The sexual revolution has made possible more understanding of the physiological and psychological complexities of sex, has helped men and women have healthier attitudes toward their own sexuality, and has created greater openness about sex, and has made possible more positive and more fulfilled sexual expressions. But it has also opened the way for unscrupulous people to exploit our need for intimacy. Keeping our erotic poise requires self-discipline for all of us, whether we're married or not. But we believe that one of the benefits of that self-discipline is what I referred to earlier, that sex may be part of our eternal identities. As LDS therapist Carver Broderick said, "The eternal preservation of reproductive sexuality is the central distinguishing characteristic differentiating the exalted from the merely saved." Well, how much more time do I have? About 3 minutes. Not enough time to say all the things that I wanted to say. Let me kind of cut to the end of my extended remarks by saying that I think that in an essay that I wrote recently, I published in Dialogue, called "The Goodness of the Church," I talk about some of these ideas as part of what I consider the goodness of the church. That the church does teach us the goodness of sexuality. It does teach us the principles that may allow us to find appropriate sexual expression. I wish there were time for me to talk about the experience I had as a bishop in dealing with homosexual members of the church, because that is another very important chapter, one that has not really been addressed here today, but which is significant within Mormon culture, and I think significant in the culture at large, but one that I think needs addressing. I looked at this list of quotations that you provided for us, and as I quickly scanned them, one of them caught my eye. A student at an evangelical university, which I think could also fit a student at a Latter-day Saint or one. "I'm supposed to be a great Christian," this man says, "I'm supposed to be a great Christian guy, and I have sexual feelings, and with God I feel guilty. And I ask God to forgive me, and I feel that I'm going to run out of grace." To the extent that young Latter-day Saints feel that they may run out of grace, I think is a condemnation of the way we deal with sexuality within our culture. The one inexhaustible thing in the universe is the grace and the love of God. We sing in our song, "If I Could Hide a Kolob," about there is no end to all of these things. The one thing that we don't have in there, we say there's no end to love, there's no end to race, there's no anything. That song does not include there is no end to grace, but there is no end to grace. And all of us, whatever our sexual experience, whatever our sexual identities, whatever, however we feel about it, will always be in need of God's abundant grace. Thank you.
To all of our panelists, we have some time for Q&A, and if you would please come up and speak your questions in the microphone, then they will be recorded, and I'm going to try to pass this one to our panelists.
Thank you so much to the panel members. I thought that was a terrific, this has been a terrific session so far. I have a question for Heidi. You talked about, you were trying to define, do we have a divided consciousness, do we have a conflictual kind of relationship between the liberal theology and the conservative behavior. I want to kind of push you on that a little bit more, and I'm not sure about the right word either, but when I was young in the church, there were a lot of negative messages about sexuality that conflicted with what you were supposed to feel in marriage. So I remember being taught all these chastity lessons where, you know, if you lost your virtue, you know, you were like the licked piece of bread or something. You know, they had these lessons that you would do where you'd pass around a piece of cake or something and everybody mangled it. And so if you were the girl that lost your virtue, well, obviously that's trying to get this reinforce a certain kind of behavior, but it seems there is another message that comes out as well. One of my comedian friends once said, Lori Meekum, if any of you know her, when she's doing her Relief Society routine with the chastity lesson, her message to the girls is, sex is dirty and disgusting and awful, and you should save it for the one you love. And I think that that's a message that we have. Well, how does that affect you when you get married? Does some of that come? I guess my real question to you is, do you think that's still being given as a message to the younger generation in the church today, that sex is dirty and disgusting, but it's also somehow eternally wonderful, and how do we deal with that?
First of all, I wanted to say I have also heard the chewed up gum lesson and the stained wedding dress lesson. Of them, I haven't had them talk to me. But I think you're right. I think that there are places and people that still teach it. In the last session, it was mentioned that, you know, sometimes it takes a few generations for things to sort of recycle out of the system, because we are a lay ministry and people talk about their experience and what they were taught before. But as for my personal experience, I feel like it's being discouraged, openly discouraged to talk in that way or to refer to sexuality in that way, even though I think that there still are some repercussions to past thought and past lessons. And if anyone wants to, do you want to comment on that? Okay.
It's interesting, actually, for me to hear about the cake, the broken cake example or activity. One of the things that came up a lot, I've done a very broad work with evangelical youth culture beyond the study that I did, and True Love Waits, which is one of the big national evangelical-run abstinence pledge programs, one of its main activities is actually you either take a piece of fruit or you take a puzzle heart, and the activity, and this is now, the activity is that you have a girl, generally, sometimes a guy, stand up at the front of the room, and then if it's a girl, you have a string of guys come up and either sort of take a chunk out of, you know, an orange, or take a piece of the heart away until the girl has nothing left. And that's the example of what happens if you date. people. And so with an evangelical youth culture, generally the goal is courtship. So you only date the person you're going to marry, and if you don't, you're giving a piece away of your heart that you can never get back. And so this is part of that abstinence pledge program. And so that idea that sex is very, very dirty and you save it for the one you love, that paradox is very much alive among the evangelical youth that I've talked with and spoken to, and both from my study and outside of that.
Next question.
Follow up a little bit on what Margaret said. I recently talked to the bishop, my daughter, who lives in Spanish Fork, and I asked him what he was going to turn around, what does he teach in his ward, and what does he teach as far as morality. And he said he had the example about, he talked all about having a Christmas present, and who'd want to have a Christmas present on Christmas morning that had already been opened. And I stopped and I said, you know, I know a lot of people who were molested as children, and their present was opened involuntarily. So, according to your analogy, they should only date other people who have opened their present previously. And he stopped for a second. He was dumbfounded. And he, like, had never thought of that possibility. And what could you possibly do? But I have a friend who. Whose brother is a regional representative. This has to do more with not young adults, but young single adults, but single adults, ones that are 30 and over. And he had talked to his brother, who was the regional representative for them, and he came to him and he said, boy, we just had a meeting recently on the Wasatch Front, and it's really disturbing because it turns out that 80% of the single adults, ones over 30, are sexually active at some point between the time they get divorced and they remarry again. And he said, could that number possibly be accurate, and what are we supposed to do about that? It seems like once people have gone to the well and drank from the well, to return to that well becomes a very easy thing to do. Does anyone have any comments on that?
Well, I think that I think there's a little question that people we are wired to be together with another human being. We are wired to seek and to want intimacy, and you know, Aristotle's idea was that somehow we were one person in the beginning, and that male and female got separated, and that all of us are trying to find our way back to that other person. This doesn't take into account homosexuals, but at least within heterosexuality, that we don't feel whole until we find that other person who fulfills us. So I know nothing about the statistics, but I would know again from my experience of having people in my ward who, when I first became bishop, went from 18 to 40, that the longer the older the people got, the more anxiety there was about this, and the more that, you know, the women spoke about what they called the Laurel Lie, which was that they were promised that they did all of these things, they would find this wonderful man who would love them and take them to the temple and do all of those things, and they were 30 or 35 and they'd done all of those things and it hadn't happened, and some of them were in that attitude of, well, what the heck, why should I keep trying to do that? So I don't know, but I think sexuality is our common lot, it is our common experience, and for most people it's a common burden.
Thanks for this panel, it's been very interesting. I have two daughters, twins, 12 years old. They're just going into junior high, just going into adolescence. You've got me scared about what is coming. And I was wondering if each of the panelists might have some advice for maybe myself and other parents whose children are about to go into this. I'm a little nervous about the Young Women's Program and some of the things that Margaret and Harry alluded to, maybe some negative messages they can get. But on the other hand, I really hope they can avoid this hookup culture that you've described, and which just doesn't sound like very good. And so any advice for us parents, I'd love to hear it.
I don't feel very adequate because I'm relatively young. Although at BYU I was pretty old to be single. But I would say from my experience in Young Women's that I think, like I sort of mentioned in my paper, institutional literature is still, in my characterization, pretty evangelical in its reasons and its emphasis of this purity culture that if you read Donna's book, she goes more into, and its positive and negative effects for women, especially. What I wish, I guess personally, that I could have gotten is more emphasis maybe from my parents of these uniquely Mormon ideas that gave me a lot of comfort and strength and confidence in my sexuality and its goodness. And also, by emphasizing its goodness, it made me more able to, stand up for what I wanted to do instead of emphasizing its badness. but I didn't get that until I felt like I went to college when people were talking about it more openly in roommates, in Sunday school, when we were the ones teaching each other and not necessarily the older women or the older men. So for your young children, I would say talk to them. I mean, that sounds kind of obvious, but talk to them. and emphasize the goodness more and what you can do and why. That's all I would say.
Although I'm not a psychologist, I understand that girls learn their essential psychosexual identity from their fathers. I mean, they learn from both. But it was, I would say that your relationship with them and how you model your own affection with them and your own sexuality in terms of your just being a sexual person as a whole person, that is, that they understand that this is normal, this is part of who you are, it's part of who they are. And then if I had twin girls, I'd say, never be out of your sister's presence.
I guess I would say two different things on this issue, and one of them sounds probably a little fatalistic, but one of the things that I found in the study was that it didn't matter much what your parents taught you about sex and relationships once you got to college because of hookup culture. And so young first-year students tend to be swept up in it just the first weekend that they're there without thinking much about it because it's so it's very, very powerful. So having said that, the parallel I would have would be evangelical colleges and students who, the chances of students staying, navigating sexuality and romance within the context of their religious tradition are sky high if you go to an evangelical college, whereas evangelical students I interviewed who didn't go to an evangelical college tended to just, their faith life tended to crumble while they were at whatever school they were at. So maybe you would want to send your children to BYU, even though I'm sure it's not a perfect place. There are students who struggle and there are students who I'm sure love the culture of chastity. However, the one thing that was really significant at, I guess, non-evangelical colleges or non-religiously affiliated colleges that kept students in contact with their faith. So if you are looking beyond colleges and universities beyond Mormon-affiliated ones, was finding out if there is a very robust Mormon youth group on campus and making sure that on the campus tour you find it and that you make sure your daughters or your sons go there right away when they get to college and you follow up and you ask them, did you go? And those were the students who, when they found campus communities that were of their own tradition, that they really were able to practice their faith in a robust way. But most of the other students just kind of fell away while they were in college. So, yeah.
I would encourage you to have them go to the Young Women's Program. I think the peer relationships there and the reinforcement of who they are is much more positive than it is negative.
All right, and going off of what Donna was saying, I was still single when I left BYU. It was hard. But when I got to BU, which is not a church college, obviously. What was helpful for me was, you know, of course, the institute program, having a singles board, all these factors that she's talking about, a very strong community. So, yeah.
We have two people who've been waiting for questions, so let's have those last two questions quickly and a couple quick responses.
I was just wondering, any of you can tackle this, but in my personal experience, it seems like I've seen that one of the greatest contributing factors to, you know, having sex at an earlier age and the hookup culture that you're talking about is just that our society has seemed to not teach the difference between sex and love and intimacy in a way that youth understand so that they can kind of sort those things out. And so a lot of youth, are, especially young girls, are looking for intimacy and love, and they think that they can get that through sex. I was just wondering if you had any comments on that, or if there were other contributing factors that you saw in your research or experience that were main factors that contributed to this type of thing.
I would say that the number one reason that women identified as why they hook up was to get into a relationship. So it was like they were gambling, and they knew that that wasn't the best way to get into a relationship, but they felt like dating wasn't an option. And this is not even open colleges, so bracketing. And I actually had one student say at one point, finding a guy who will go out with you is like playing the lottery. You have to have sex with 99 of them before number 100 will actually want to date you. And so, and as it turns out, hookup culture is the worst way to get into a fulfilling romantic relationship for most of these students, as they reported. So, because it really does, when students define romance in my study, they defined it as communication, talking for hours, getting to know someone, gazing into someone's eyes, and you get none of that in hookup culture, but that seems to be what people really want.
Just been told that the current issue of Sunstone, which came out yesterday, has a large section on some of these questions that we've been raising here, and it is available for purchase right outside. It has a large sunset on the cover if you are interested in continuing this conversation through the magazine. I want to thank our panelists today who does such a wonderful job, and I'm sure that they will be available for you if you would like to talk to them. Also, Donna Freitas will be signing books over in the Benchmark Books area at 1:30 this afternoon. Thank you so much.